Thank you, Neil, and thanks for inviting me. I have to say it's kind of a bummer to miss out meeting people in person, but I find it a lot easier than traveling sometimes to do this kind of chime in. But in any case, please do ask questions as I go along. I hope to cover a lot of ground, so we'll see how far I can get. But of course, the idea is, as a cosmologist, I want to tell you about some of the new ways which we've used to probe the nature of dark matter, and of course the motivation, in case we have any students joining the call, is that we live in a dark universe. Most of the matter in our universe is dark matter, and we want to understand what this dark matter is. And so everything that I talk about will, in kind of a somewhat sneaky way, be relying on assuming the dark matter particles. Well, the first dark matter is particles, and then that those particles interact in some way with the Standard Model particles, so the matter as we know it. And so I want to summarize the background, the theoretical background that I'm going to be working in using this diagram, and to point out that cosmology and cosmological probes that I want to talk about today, in some sense, probe the same errors in this diagram as many laboratory experiments that have been sort of the benchmark for the probes of the dark matter physics, which are the direct rejection experiments. But unlike direct rejection experiments, cosmological probes can directly test cosmological dark matter, so the stuff that galaxies, live in. And it has some advantages over the lab experiments. In particular, it's independent of the local phase-space distribution of dark matter, so we don't have to worry about uncertainties related to that. But it also explores light dark matter particles, so below the masses of the standard weakly interacting massive particle, below the standard WIMP, and also high cross sections where direct rejection experiments cannot reach. But the theory context is pretty much the same, and there's been a lot of work along these lines. I list some of the papers of other groups on the right-hand side there for reference. Now, the way that I like to think about how cosmology probes physics of dark matter, and in particular interacting dark matter, which I'm going to call IDM on my slides from now on, splits into three categories of probes. On the one hand, dark matter particles can affect the expansion history, in particular at very early times, at the times of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and so can alter the abundances of light elements that were created during BBN. Another way is to alter the thermal history of the universe and the ionization history at the times when first galaxies and first stars were forming. And then also finally, dark matter particles and dark matter interactions can affect the distribution of matter in our universe and pretty significantly impact the formation of structure in our universe. So the formulas there is just for those of you who actually worry about cosmological calculations on a daily basis. The rest of us, you don't have to pay attention to the details in there, but this is just to give you a flavor of what kinds of equations we end up changing when we try to account for the effects, for cosmological effects of interacting dark matter. So I'm going to cover probes, cosmological probes that fall in all three of these categories today. The objective of all of this work is, of course, to learn something about the mass of dark matter particles. And in that case, I will work in context of the thermal relic dark matter. I'll come back to that in the second part of my talk, but also to probe the interactions of dark matter particles. And in particular, I will focus on scattering with Standard Model particles. So those are the goals, and the tools are going to be roughly splitting the talk in four parts. I'm going to talk about what we've learned from large-scale cosmology, in particular from the CMB. And then I'll switch gears and talk about what we've learned from this relatively new field of near-field cosmology, where we actually use objects in the near universe, in the local universe, to infer something about fundamental physics. Then I'll talk about 21-centimeter cosmology, again, a very new direction that's been exciting in the recent years. And in the end, I want to cover some of what we've learned from the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Before I plunge into results, I just want to highlight the people that have done basically all the work that I'm going to cover today. So the folks whose pictures you see here are all junior people that have had the privilege to work with. The three people on the top are all our USC undergrads who have been able to publish papers on these topics. And I'll just draw your attention to Karim Amari on the top. Right, who's now applying to grad schools. And then there's my grad student, Trey Driscoll, who's done a lot of great work, and the two postdocs, Surian and Ethan Adler. All right, so first off, I wanna recap quickly what we've learned from the cosmic microwave background measurements. And these will be mostly lessons from looking at the CMB as a tracer of structure. So here is a plot from now even outdated, a little bit outdated paper from Chabani et al., summarizing how different light tracers map onto reconstructing the linear matter power spectrum. And so you can think of the CMB as a way to probe the largest scales, the very left end of this graph. And so what we do when we measure the CMB, of course, we restructure the temperature and polarization multiples. Sometimes we also measure the lensing. So I'll talk about using all three of these to learn something about dark matter microphysics. But I also want you to think of this measurement of the TT power spectrum is basically getting reconstructed from or probed by different types of experiments. So if you want to measure large scales very well, you're using something like Planck. So that probes the left-hand side of this diagram and ground-based experiments like ACT, SPT, and others probe very well the small scales. And then if you think about the next generation CMB experiments like the Simons Observatory or the CMBS4, then those guys will be pushing to probe the very right-hand side, the very smallest scales into this damping tail of the TT and polarization power spectrum. All right, so now let me place the physics of interacting dark matter in a cosmological context. Often when we talk about dark matter baryon elastic scattering, which I want to focus on for the next few slides, we in cosmology, we parameterize the momentum transfer cross-section, which describes the transfer of momentum between dark matter and baryon fluids as a power law that's shown on the left-hand side there, power law depending on the velocity, the relative velocity of dark matter and baryonic particles. Now, this momentum transfer rate depends, that's shown on the bottom there, depends on this momentum transfer cross-section. And it's also a function of the temperatures of dark matter and baryonic fluids. Now that power law index N captures all the details that cosmologists care about in terms of the dark matter theory, in terms of how this interaction looks like. However, it turns out that things are relatively simple in cosmological context because the energy scales that we deal with are fairly low. That means that the momentum transfer, that the masses of particles involved are much larger than the momentum transfer for cosmological probes and cosmological times that we're able to probe with something like the CMB. And that means we can work in context of non-relativistic effective theory. Write down the operators that describe a variety of different interactions, different contact interactions at low energies, and they tend to boil down to this kind of power law dependence in terms of the momentum transfer. Those effective theory operators give rise to positive powers of velocity dependence, and negative powers can arise if you have interactions with light mediators, for example, that are outside the scope of the effective theory. So bottom line, the reason we use these this power law to describe interactions in cosmological context is because it's sufficient. It maps out onto a whole bunch of different different theories that we can examine in a very neat and succinct way. Now, I want to draw your attention to the right-hand side, to the plot in there. And here I'm showing you the momentum transfer rate, this arc high quantity divided by the Hubble rate as a function of redshift. And what I want you to notice, first off, all of these curves have been normalized at the current bounds for these different interaction types, current bounds from the CMB. So what I want you to notice is that when you have positive powers of velocity dependence, because those relative velocities, relative particle velocities, have been for most of cosmic history sourced by thermal velocities, those positive dependences take action at very early time. So you have a lot of momentum transfer here on the right, and then interactions decouple at late times. So most of what happens, most of the cosmological imprint happens at really early times prior to recombination. The opposite is true if you want to have cases with light mediators where you have negative powers of velocity dependence. So when I mentioned negative powers, I just want to give you an example. For example, N of minus four should ring a bell as something like Coulomb interaction, where dark matter, for example, has a small electric charge. So in context of millicharge, you have a situation where momentum transfer takes off at late times in the late universe and is fairly small at early times. Okay, so this is the theory context. This is how we think about different interactions between dark matter and baryons. And so once you specify the type of interaction, that power law index, you specify the operator that you're dealing with. Your unknowns are the mass of the particle and the coupling or the cross section. And you can then compute the matter power spectrum in context of a cosmology with such an interaction, and also other observables like the CMB temperature, polarization, and lensing. So together with Kim Boddy, who's now at UT Austin, we've been able to fold in this formalism into the standard Boltzmann codes and compute the signal that one can look for in context of the CMB. So on the top here, I'm showing you the lambda CDM linear matter power spectrum in black, and then one that features dark matter proton scattering with no velocity dependence. So this is just billiard ball scattering, like the one we look for in direct detection experiments, is shown in the blue. On the bottom, you see two different types of interactions, one that's quadratic dependence on velocity and one that has no dependence on the velocity. And these are signals on the bottom in the temperature power spectrum of the CMB. So typically you see effects like the suppression of power on small scales. Sometimes there's some excess of power on small scales that resembles the effect of baryon loading. Dark matter and baryons can couple so strongly that dark matter behaves as baryons in very early times. So before I move on to actually showing you the results, I can't resist but show you this this animation that Dimple Sarnaik, one of our USC students, has made. Using the class real space interface. So this is a simulation of our universe. The height of the peaks shows the density field. And this is the density field in dark matter. So here is a simulation of a snippet of our universe, 20 megaparsecs across. Going forward in time, the dark matter perturbations just simply grow in the standard CDM cosmology. But once you add interacting dark matter, once you make dark matter coupled to baryons, you get a very different picture. You get something that looks more like baryons undergoing acoustic oscillation. So I'll play that one more time because I love to think about this visually in real space. So you have dark matter that oscillates together with baryons. And so in a cosmology, I'll go back here to this linear matter power spectrum in a cosmology with interacting dark matter, you get these dark acoustic oscillations and the suppression of power on small scales. Matt, go for it.
Hi, Vera. Nice to see you.
Hi. Good to see you, too.
So for these plots in the animation you showed, given that we know something from direct detection about the interaction of dark matter with baryons, is this sort of based on those limits, or this is some enhanced version of what you would get?
This is an enhanced version with respect to the limits that we have from the CMB. I'll show you in a second the way that direct detection limits and CMB limits compare. But just to reveal that part of the story, we usually probe down to KV dark matter masses. So this is kind of outside of the regime that direct detection can probe. In that sense, but also in the sense that we can probe larger cross sections above the ceiling of direct detection. So I'll show you comparisons in a second. But yes, this has been enhanced to be able to show you the effect.
Thanks.
All right. So here are some bounds. These are now a few years old, and of course, there's been a number of groups that have put out similar measurements. And I noticed Kier is here. I'm going to apologize to Kier that I don't have updated bounds from Lyman Alpha Forest, but please take this as a qualitative measure of the kinds of limits that we get from cosmological probes. And what I want to point out here for Matt and others is take a look at the scales on the y-axis, and you will notice that we're talking, tens of orders of magnitude above the direct detection limits. But we're also talking about masses that are also well below the usual thresholds of the bounds from direct detection. So cosmology is able to probe down to very light dark matter particles, but it's also able to probe, infinitely large cross sections in this sense. So these bounds here summarize velocity independent, spin independent interaction. And more recently, we've been able to expand them and include bounds on all of the operators up to those that describe the dependence on the momentum transfer that goes up to second order, and capturing also the kinds of interactions like you would get in Miller-charged dark matter down here with the velocities to minus fourth. So these are the bounds from CMB anisotropies that we have right now. And of course, these are just numbers that may not mean much unless you've done modeling and you have specific scales in mind. So I just want to qualitatively interpret this. What these bounds imply right now is that when the universe was about 1,000 years old, from these bounds, we know that there has been less than 1 in 100,000 proton scatterings with dark matter. So 1 in 100,000 scatterings that a proton experiences at that age could have been with dark matter particles. More recently, and this is now work, but David and Impel, who were undergrads and now are graduate students, they have modified our class code, including the scattering with electrons, and been able to produce the same bounds for electron scattering. And here I want to show you how those compare with the bounds that we have from direct detection experiments. So here you see two examples that are of particular interest to the direct detection community. On the left-hand side, there's an interaction, Coulomb-like interaction, with a scattering momentum transfer cross-section that scales as velocity to the minus fourth power. And on the right-hand side is velocity to the minus second power. So something like scattering through an electric dipole. Now on the vertical axis is a quantity that direct detection electronic recoil based measurements usually use. And this quantity, sigma E with a bar, is related through the form factor of interest to the quantity that you've been seeing on previous plots, so that constant sigma naught that we've been constraining. So we've done this translation in order to be able to put these numbers from cosmological bounds on the same plot as the bounds from direct detection experiments. I want to get your attention to the fact that some of these, so the shaded regions are excluded by given experiments. So the gray shaded regions are excluded by direct detection experiments. And the red is a bound that we've derived from Planck. I want to get your attention to the fact that there are some dashed lines here, and some of these direct detection bounds stop at a certain point. Where the dashed lines begin, that's where you have the ceiling for a given experiment as derived in previous studies. So direct ejection in principle is unable to probe interactions that are too strong where dark matter would be stopped in the atmosphere or in the shielding, the extensive shielding that these experiments have. All right, so the bottom line is, again, we probe infinitely high cross-sections and we're able to reach down to very small dark matter masses and probe entirely new parameter space using cosmological probes. Just a very quick shout out, with future experiments like CNDS-4 and the Simons Observatory, we expect to be able to push the current bounds shown in black line here down by a couple of orders of magnitude in terms of the cross-section. And we also, speaking very qualitatively, ask me more questions if you're interested in the end. We also don't expect that interacting dark matter signals could be confused for other science targets, like, for example, neutrino mass or annihilating dark matter and so forth. They look very, very different in the CMB power spectrum. All right. I'll pause there for a second to see if there are any questions. James.
Yeah, so just a quick question about that last point. I mean, is it going to be useful to do experiments given that? Like, how compared to the detection limits you were showing, the lab-based detection limits?
Yeah, so in terms of the small masses, this does mean that we can push, you know, significantly lower into that parameter space where the current direct detection experiments cannot reach. There are going to be new direct detection experiments based on new technologies that are trying to push towards light dark matter. So I can't give you the numbers because I don't know that there are detailed forecasts and they're very model dependent as well. But whether this will be worthwhile doing or not, we will have this data for other reasons. And the analysis are straightforward generalizations of the stuff we've done already.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so next I want to tell you about some stuff we've learned from near-field cosmology. So now we're going to use things like dwarf galaxies, smallest galaxies in the local universe, and in particular those that are satellites of our own Milky Way, to probe the matter-power spectrum on very small scale. So now we're going from the far left-hand side to the far right-hand side in this diagram. And the observational context for this is that we have amazing surveys already. So Dark Energy Survey has been able to identify a whole bunch of new dwarf galaxies. And you will see what we've been able to learn about dark matter interactions from those. I'll show you that in a few slides. But then there are upcoming surveys like LSST that are going to push that inventory of known dwarfs even further. So this is my kind of quick summary of how we learn about dark matter physics from near-field cosmology. So what I'm showing you here is the transfer function, the ratio between the power spectrum, linear matter power spectrum for interacting cosmology versus that from cold dark matter cosmology. So the one that is suppressed versus the one where you have just the standard non-interacting picture. And the three lines that you see there come from warm dark matter, the red, the dashed is from interacting dark matter that I talked about previously in the CMB context. And then you have fuzzy dark matter, where dark matter is a scalar field, not necessarily featuring any interactions. And so the upshot of this is that most often what happens is when you introduce new dark matter microphysics, most often you end up suppressing power on smallest of scales. So this is a sense in which going from large scale structure probes, including the CMB, towards near field cosmology, where you're probing tracers of very small scales, might actually help enhance sensitivity to the microphysics of dark matter. So the suppression of power, like the one you see in these three models at small scales, will generically lead to underabundance of small dark matter halos throughout cosmic history. And so looking to measure the population of smallest halos can give us bounds and then hopefully provide the venue for potential detection of these kinds of effects. Okay, so I want to go through two case studies, warm dark matter and interacting dark matter. So here are the transfer functions for these two cosmologies. And what I wanted to point out in this plot is that the warm dark matter suppression that you guys may have been used to seeing is shown in the dashed lines here for different warm dark matter masses. The farther you go towards large scales, the smaller the mass of warm dark matter, the larger the suppression at any fixed scale. So this one has the smallest value of the mass, and then mass increases as you go farther to the right. What I want you to notice is that the warm dark matter transfer functions map really well on the interacting dark matter transfer functions, at least for the case where the interactions are velocity independent. But in this case, the cross-section, if you increase the cross-section, you suppress larger and larger scales. So in other words, you're moving this cutoff to the left-hand side of this diagram. So the smaller scales you can map, the more you can push the sensitivity to a smaller and smaller cross-section. All right, so now when we talk about the warm dark matter and interacting dark matter, we are very often secretly working in the context that assumes that the dark matter is a thermal relic. So let me just really quickly go over my terminology when I talk about the thermal relic. What exactly do I mean? I mean a particle that starts off in thermal kinetic and chemical equilibrium in the early universe, equilibrium with the rest of the universe, the rest of the standard model particles. And so all three directions in this diagram are taking place early on. And then if you have a chemical decoupling, you shut off either production or annihilation or both. And in that case, you have the onset of the freeze out. You freeze the thermal relic abundance of these particles. This happens when the inelastic scattering rate matches the Hubble rate and falls below it. Kinetic decoupling will happen when you also shut off the elastic scattering. Okay, so when I was talking about the interacting dark matter, I was talking about that process, the elastic scattering between dark matter and standard model particles, denoted as X in this diagram. And that'll happen when the elastic scattering rate falls below the Hubble rate. And finally, you get the thermal decoupling, followed by free streaming when all of these interactions are too slow compared to the expansion of the universe. All right, so in terms of the diagram of the abundance of dark matter, once you shut off the production of dark matter, so the annihilations of the standard model particles freeze out and you no longer create dark matter particles, that occurs when you have the turnover in this diagram. And at that point, dark matter has become non-relativistic. And then the freeze out happens at a later time when you can no longer annihilate either. All right. Now, in the case of warm dark matter, you have a thermal relic that decouples while it's still semi-relativistic. And so it inherits appreciable velocity dispersion from those early times, just like neutrinos do. And so you end up having the collisionless damping of very small scale. So this is the feature that we see. This is the cutoff that we see in these transfer functions. Now, what that means in practice, when we look at the simulations like these ones here, these are simulations done by Ruyan and Ethan Adler. On the left-hand side, you have cold dark matter. On the right-hand side, you have very slightly warm dark matter. And you may not even be with the naked eye able to pick out the differences, but there is a smoothing of scales on the right-hand side. There is a suppression of power on the smallest scales and a lack of very smallest dark matter halos. Now, current bounds from the measurements of the population of the Milky Way satellites put a lower limit on the mass of the warm dark matter particle at about 7 keV or so. And there's also bounds of similar order of magnitude from the Lyman-Alpha forest and other measurements. Now, depending on what model of warm dark matter you're interested in, you may start to talk about perhaps the sterile neutrinos, warm dark matter, and so forth. But what I want you to take from this is that once you've put the bound on the mass of the warm dark matter, you've identified the biggest cutoff, the largest scale of the cutoff in this transfer function that your data can tolerate. So this bound from the population of the Milky Way satellites implies maps onto a cutoff that's shown on the left-hand side in the transfer function that begins at about 30 inverse megaparsecs. Now, I want to use this information to be able to say something about the interacting dark matter. In the case of interacting dark matter, you have a slightly different picture. Instead of collisionless damping, interacting dark matter models typically assume that you have elastic scattering at some point in cosmic history. They don't necessarily assume a thermal relic, but we'll see that the interaction cross-sections that we're able to currently probe do imply that this particle was a thermal relic at early times. So in the case when you have interactions between dark matter and photon barium fluid, you actually get collisional damping as we've seen in those simulations. So you erase structure on smallest of scales. All right, so now what I wanna do is I wanna show you how we've been able to use the bounds on the amount of suppression that one can get and still be consistent with the observed population of Milky Way satellites and translate it into the bounds on the interacting dark matter. All right, so in the case of interacting dark matter, we know that once the momentum transfer rate that's controlled by the interaction cross-section and the mass of the particle, both of which are unknown parameters, once that momentum transfer rate reaches the Hubble rate and falls below it, that is when these particles decouple from the rest of the universe, thermally decouple. So the idea here is now to translate this condition into saying, okay, so if I have a given cross-section, for example, this one here, all the density perturbation modes that enter cosmological horizon prior to decoupling will be suppressed. And then all those that enter after the decoupling will not be suppressed. Okay, so this is the main idea. So we can compute the momentum transfer rate, as I've shown you before, that's a function of cross-section and mass of the particle. And we can figure out at what point in cosmic history, at what redshift does this decoupling occur for that cross-section. Now, at that point in cosmic history, we can evaluate the size of cosmological horizon and then start from the size of the cosmological horizon at the moment of decoupling. And then we want to relate that size to the halo mass that will arise from perturbations of that given size, okay? Now, this is this relationship between the mass of the halos and the size of the perturbation. You would need to run cosmological simulations to actually calculate this relationship or to relate the two quantities. But in linear theory, you can do it to within order of magnitude. And so bear with me, I'm gonna go with linear theory here. But we'll see that it gives us extremely accurate results. So I can say within the perturbation of a given size, how much mass is contained if I take into account the average density of the universe. And in doing this, I can relate the size of the halos that would be the last that would be corresponding to the perturbations that were the last to enter cosmological horizon at the moment of decoupling. So that gives me the relationship between the mass of the smallest halos I should see in the interacting cosmology and interaction cross-section. So in other words, this gives me an order of magnitude estimate for where in this diagram should I see the cutoff in power. Okay, now fast forward, and this is work done by Ethan Adler, who's now USC Carnegie postdoctoral fellow. doing this order of magnitude estimate basically gives you an estimate on the smallest halos that appear in interacting cosmologies. And so you can compute the maximum cross-section that you can have that wouldn't suppress the population of Milky Way satellites beyond what is allowed by the data. Now, what Ethan has done is the full likelihood analysis of the Milky Way satellite population, so going beyond this order of magnitude estimate, but actually modeling the whole population of the satellites from DES and PanSTARRS data, including realistic modeling of the galaxy halo connection and marginalizing over all the unknowns of this model, taking into account the disruption of satellites by the Milky Way disk, and also taking into account emulating the observations of the satellite, taking into account their luminosity distribution, size distribution, and their radial distribution within the Milky Way halo. So marginalizing over all the nuisance parameters of this model, these are the 95% bounds that Ethan's been able to derive on the interaction cross-section as a function of mass. And so notice there in the bottom right corner, the gray regions would be excluded by direct detection experiments. So this is your standard velocity independent contact interaction. But notice again, we pulled the bounds to much lower masses. And at this point, the satellites are able to bridge the gap between our previous CMB limits and the very top of that ceiling in direct detection experiments. Okay, I'll pause there for a second to see if there are any questions. Matt, go for it.
I guess I'm a bit confused the relevance of the direct detection if we're talking about dark matter self interactions.
These are not self interactions. These are this is elastic scattering with baryons. So
elastic literally scattering with baryons. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Any more? Neil, go for it.
Yeah. Just to make sure I'm following this correctly. So to translate these DES bounds, your prediction is on the number of subhalos as a function of their surviving mass, but what you observe is like the galaxies as a function of like the galaxy luminosity, and so you're sort of mapping them somehow, right?
Yes, that's right.
So is this just like abundance matching, or how is this done?
Yes, basically. So, but including the modeling, like a very detailed model of galaxy halo connection, allowing for very broad, priors on all the things we don't know very much about. So you would imagine that the mapping is very accurate on mass scales where we have very good measurements of the population, and then your error bars blow up as you go. Near the 10 to the 8 solar masses, which is where the current minimum halo mass bounds are.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. And the take home from everything I've said, if I plotted on this diagram, so the red line here is from DS and PanSTARRS, the blue one is from SDSS. Sorry, I didn't say that. If I put a line that's from the analytic estimates that I talked about in the previous few slides, you get a line that is within a factor of a few from that. So it's it's even the linear theory consideration, even this order of magnitude gives you a sensible answer. And then once you fold in all the uncertainties that we have, this answer doesn't get changed by a whole lot. Daniel?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, go for it.
So I have a question. So a lot of the constraints from the satellites come from assuming a particular model for the subhalo mass function, right? So there's a particular suppression function, usually parameterized in terms of like the half mode mass or something, right? Mm-hmm. And so you do this, you get some constraint on the half mode mass, assuming that particular model for the mass function. Mm-hmm. And then you step back and you look at different transfer functions. And yeah. I guess my question is that, you know, different shapes of the transfer function will produce different shapes in the mass function.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So the limit that you get on like the half mode scale depends on the shape of the mass function. So how do you go into a different transfer function without actually changing the accounting for the difference in the mass function?
That's right. You don't. In this case, the mapping is so the simulations have been done that were used to calibrate this method for warm dark matter, right? So there's been plenty of simulations using warm dark matter, not so much using interacting dark matter. So we've used this fact to look at the bounds on warm dark matter where the transfer function almost perfectly matches that of interacting dark matter. So notice that the differences begin where you get these tiny dark acoustic oscillations on the right. So the mapping down to half mode mass, which is about this star sign here, is almost perfect between the two. But even when it's not, there is you can make a very conservative, as I'll show you in a couple of slides, I'll take this farther. You can make very conservative bounds by saying, I want to make sure. So I want to say that everything is allowed that suppresses power less, at least as much or less than these warm dark matter transfer functions. Anything that takes away power more than is allowed by warm dark matter transfer function is disallowed. Now, in order to actually, if we saw a suppression, in order to derive, to infer what that implies about dark matter parameters, yes, you're right. You have to actually know the mapping between the specific transfer function and your halo mass function, which we don't without running simulations. But you can still put conservative bounds. So there is a difference. Putting bounds is easier than actually deriving, a measurement from a different transfer function. So we're being super conservative in the sense that we're basically saying with this analysis, if there's a few halos at the mass that corresponds to this suppression, this amount of suppression, right, where you should not have any halos, then that disallows that part of the parameter space.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
Okay. But just to follow up on that, Vera. So, like, in the example you're showing here, so the warm dark matter and your interacting dark matter transfer functions, the shapes look quite similar on the scale where it's damping, but then at higher K, then you have these oscillations.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so, do those, are they ever important?
Let me get to that.
Okay.
I was heading there. So everything I showed you so far, these bounds are for velocity independent scattering where the oscillations are fairly small. Now, when you have velocity dependent scattering, and I saw one more hand, let me go a little bit further so I can address Neil's question here. There are models, and the higher up in N you go, the more prominent these oscillations become. So now you have transfer functions here for different models where you can no longer ignore the amount of power that you have at these progressively smaller scales. James, go for it.
This would come naturally out of the warm dark matter simulations, but there is also top-down structure formation once you cut off the power spectrum. So it's not the case you never get any structure below the cutoff. It's that structure forms later, right? And you get a sort of tail repopulating itself. I don't know if that's relevant in this problem or if you noticed that.
Yeah, so in order to figure out the amount of you're talking about like maybe fragmentation or like formation of...
Right. So you should get some fragmentation and you should get some small things,
yeah.
But they'll form later and they'll be less abundant.
Yeah. So all the bounds that I'm showing you are trying to be very, very conservative in this sense, but we haven't investigated this in greater detail than relying on the simulations that we have right now. We're looking into starting to run simulations with this dark acoustic oscillation features. I will say there are Ethos models that produce similar dark acoustic features, but they're not that easy to map onto these models. There's not like a very obvious way to map them onto these interacting cosmologies. So this is something that we're going to be looking at in the coming years. Okay, so I'll proceed here and tell you about what we've been able to do so far in the models where there are prominent dark acoustic oscillations. And now this is the work done by Karima Murray, who's our undergrad. This guy is amazing. If he applies to any grad schools that you guys may be a part of, pay attention to him. This guy delivered the results that I'm going to show you within less than a month of working. All right, so now I want to take a step back and take this bound on warm dark matter as implying a bound on the maximum amount of suppression in this transfer function that is tolerated by the data. And again, I'll rely on the measurements from DES and PENSTARRS to do this. And I want to show you the method that we've used, again, like completely analytic, trying to derive a very conservative bounds on these models where the dark acoustic oscillations are fairly prominent. So for any of the models, you can ask a question of what is the cross-section for a given dark matter mass that I can have in order to make sure that all those dark acoustic features are below the transfer function for warm dark matter at the mass limit. Okay, so the shaded region here is supposed to indicate in a very, you know, heuristic way, the region of the parameter space that is excluded by the measurements of the satellite population. So if you tweak your cross-section such that all of these curves ensure a suppression that's much more severe, especially on these scales 10 to the 11th and to the 10 solar masses, then you would have in a warm dark matter cosmology, we can call these kinds of cross-sections that produce such a suppression inconsistent with the current data. Similarly, or conversely, I'm going to call everything that suppresses structure less, as much or less than the currently current bound warm dark matter consistent with the current data. Okay. Now, doing this, you can derive order of magnitude bounds in this sense, in a conservative way, on all of these interaction models that I talked about in context of the CMB. And here I'm showing those bounds for a variety of power laws. I want to get your attention to the power law index that's denoted in each one of these panels. So shaded regions are excluded by the gray shaded regions by previous measurements, CMB, Lyman, Alpha 4, spectral distortions. And then the blue solid lines represent the current bounds derived in this manner using this analytic method from the Milky Way satellites. So what you can see from this is, you know, while I forget now, Daniel. Like Daniel mentioned, you know, these transfer functions don't map onto each other in any reasonable way, and we cannot use simulations that involve warm dark matter in order to measure parameters of interacting dark matter. But we can very conservatively say that something that suppresses power to this degree is disallowed by the data. So it is these blue transfer functions that you see here, this level of suppression is what implies the bounds that you see on these figures, okay? So even doing this already excludes 3 to 5 orders of magnitude more of the parameter space as compared to the CMB bounds. So using the same method, we've been able to put bounds on scattering with electrons. So this previous result was related specifically to scattering with protons. If we look at scattering with electrons, here I'm showing on the left-hand side is a highlight comparison for the case of velocity-independent interactions. So this is the standard interaction that we look for in direct detection experiments. And this plot shows the comparison with a bunch of bounds from direct detection. The red is our Planck bound that I talked about previously. And then the blue is the bound that we get from the Milky Way satellites. And we've been able to repeat this for all positive powers of velocity events. Okay, I want to conclude the near field cosmology story, and then I'll ask you what you want me to tell you about very quickly. There are two options. But the bottom line is that what we've been able to do so far is to use the small scale structure probes to study fundamental physics, but in a very conservative way, targeting bounds. So not enabling discovery, but rather targeting bounds. And of course, the reason that using small scales is more difficult than using something like the CMB is because we're talking about nonlinear scales that are difficult to model for all sorts of reasons. So not only are satellites more difficult to measure than perhaps the CMB in some ways. We need to measure the galaxies and then infer what the halos are doing underneath and so forth. But also we need a way in order to move from trying to use these analytic methods to actually understanding what these specific transfer functions are doing to the population of satellites, we would need a fast way of forward modeling the observables from the interacting dark matter cosmology and using nonlinear theory, using the simulations themselves. Okay, I'll pause there and see if there are questions now that I've gone through this part. Keir, hi.
Hi, Vera. Yeah, I have a slightly more general question, which is in these parameter spaces that you're showing, mm-hmm. are there any particularly interesting targets from a particle physics point of view? Are there particular cross sections, masses that we should be focusing on?
Yeah, so I will show you some possibly particularly interesting cross sections and masses in the next context. The idea of the work that I've shown you so far is to be as model independent as humanly possible and try to really distill what are the general things that cosmology can probe without relying on a particular model. And this is the motivation for going to this velocity power law parameterization.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay, so I think I'm gonna tell you a little bit about 21 centimeter cosmology and some new stuff that I think is really exciting that we've been able to derive in context, in particular of the edges signal. But I wanna ask Neil, how many more minutes do you wanna give me? So I know.
We started a few minutes late. So I don't know, maybe like 5-10 minutes.
Okay, so the idea of 21 centimeter cosmology is, of course, probing the dark ages and cosmic dawn, the portions of this cosmic history where we haven't yet talked about dark matter interactions, at least in this talk. So I've talked about the CMB, I've talked about the local universe. I want to hit this middle ground now. So the idea of 21 centimeter intensity mapping, of course, is to, as you know, like many of the folks there at Perimeter are involved in these experiments, is to measure the emission or absorption from neutral hydrogen in the period that leads to the dawn of stars in our universe. So between redshifts of, let's say, 30 and 10 or so. What we expect to see in standard cosmology, I'll just draw your attention to the black line on the right-hand side here. I'm shortening this part of the talk a little bit, forgive that. So what we expect to see at high redshifts during dark ages is this absorption signal against the CMB backlight due to the atomic transitions in neutral hydrogen. And of course, a few years ago, there was this big announcement by the EDGES collaboration, a small experiment in the Australian desert led by Bauman and others that reported a detection of this absorption trough, just like we expected at redshifts of about 18. This is the brightness temperature at 21 centimeter transition. And of course, there's still a debate in the community whether the signal is in the sky or maybe a systematic. And if it's in the sky, is it cosmological or actually maybe our misunderstanding or mismodeling of the foreground signal from our own galaxy? But I want to take it at face value for the moment. And I want to show you something interesting that we've learned recently about the signal. So one thing that was reported is, of course, that this signal, this trough, is by a factor of two or so too deep, much deeper than what we expected in standard cosmology. Now, without going into too much detail, I want to highlight that the depth of this trough, in a sense, measures the temperature of baryons at these very high redshifts. So the deeper the trough, the colder the baryons at that timer. Now, we can model baryons very well. If they show up colder than in standard cosmology, one of the immediate ideas should be maybe they are in thermal contact with something even colder than them. And something even colder that's around is dark matter. So Barkana proposed that perhaps it's an interaction like Miller charge that is velocity to the minus fourth, dependence in the momentum transfer cross section that drives this depth of the edges signal. So Miller charge, the idea was, could possibly avoid some of the cosmological bounds and take action in the late universe when the universe cools down, the velocities drop, so these interactions intensify. And this interaction would put in thermal contact dark matter with baryons at late times, at redshifts of 18 or 20 or so. And so then as you ramp up the interaction cross-section, you can deepen the signal as shown on the right-hand side here. This is plot done by Trey Driscoll. Okay, so this was the idea to explain the edges signal is the heat transfer between the two fluids. And from the amount of heat transfer you need in order to achieve such a signal, Barkana was able to derive this plot where the blue is the preferred region of the parameter space in terms of the cross-section versus dark matter mass. So again, the same kind of plot that I've been showing throughout this talk. Okay. So first off, soon after this came out, we and other groups have put out a limits on Miller charge from the CMB. And so here is the Miller charge, epsilon versus dark matter mass. If you want to explain edges, you need to live above the black line. If you want to satisfy the CMB bounds, everything about that red line is excluded. So we've shown that Planck and edges are inconsistent if you want to have more than 0.5% of all dark matter Miller charged. So these were really, really strong bounds. And so the only part that was left is to maybe explain the signal using this kind of scattering velocity minus fourth, but not on charged particles, but rather on neutral particles. So this would be something similar, but different than Miller charge. Okay, so I think this was a really nice illustration of how, establishing a discovery really requires us to be able to see consistencies among different cosmological data sets. But more recently, we've been able to look into this in a bit more detail. And this is now work done by Trey Driscoll at USC. So here is back again that plot of how the signal deepens as you introduce heat transfer between dark matter and baryons. However, one thing that hasn't been taken into account in any of these calculations of the effects of Miller charge on the global signal is the fact that these interactions end up actually also suppressing structure. They end up erasing fluctuations on a variety of scales. So here I'm showing you results from the modified version of class code that includes Miller charge-like interaction. So here is a transfer function. Parameter between different curves here is the interaction cross-section. And you can see that as you increase the cross-section, you suppress more and more even the scales that are well visible to the CMB and large-scale structure probes. So if you then take a semi-analytic model of Galacticus and model the population of halos in cosmologies that feature this suppression, consistent with Miller charge dark matter, you can get curves that look like this. Again, you see a suppression on a wide variety of halo masses, small ones, but also large ones as well. And if you now take that into account when you're modeling your global signal, so not only putting in the heat transfer, but also putting in the appropriate initial conditions, the appropriate transfer function, then what happens is that you end up erasing the halos that would produce the starlight, the Lyman alpha radiation, that are necessary to produce the global signal in the first place. the effect of this is very similar to what other groups have shown in the cases of warm dark matter. The global signal is delayed to much later redshifts. So what I want you to notice here is, if you want to achieve the depths that are on the order of 600 millikelvin or so, this is mislabeled. Well, no, this is not mislabeled. Okay. If you want to achieve the signals that are as deep as what Edges is showing, you end up shifting the signal to redshifts much later than where the signal was claimed to be detected. Now, if I take this and calculate the cross-sections that are implied that are consistent with Edges, we get the plot that I showed you before. So the bright regions here correspond to the sufficient suppression. So you see cross-sections that are bigger than 10 to the minus 40 or so for the Smiley-Charge models. In those cases, you end up shifting the signal below the redshift of 14. So you cannot have the signal be consistent in timing and in depth at the same time with Edges. So the upshot here is, if you have scattering with ions, Edges is inconsistent with Millicharge-like interacting dark matter. So this has nothing to do with the other bounds from other cosmological probes. This has to do with doing self-consistent modeling of the effect on structure formation and the effect on the thermal history of the universe at the same time. So we are unable to reproduce Edges when we take both into account. Okay, I will stop there because I'm out of time, but I'm happy to take any questions that people may have. And I'll very quickly fast forward to everything that I wanted to tell you before and go to my key points. If somebody wants to ask me about bounds of the mass of the thermal relic dark matter, go for that. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Vera. So let's all unmute to give her a round of applause for her great talk. Okay, so let's just take maybe like one or two questions if there are any. We've already had quite a number of questions for the speaker. But are there any last remaining questions? Okay, well then if not, okay, well then Craig, let's stop the recording here.